This is Learning from Genocide, a series brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. In these episodes, we will be giving a voice to just some of the incredible stories of human endurance in the face of evil. I'm Rachel Century, Head of Research for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and over the next few weeks, as well as talking to experts who have dedicated their lives to raising awareness, we'll also be hearing from those who have survived the Holocaust and atrocities of Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur.
There's no situation that goes from a benign society to genocide in one leap.
The mass arrests started. Some of my relatives, friends, and the people that I know were taken away.
These are the first-hand stories of the people who were there and who, against all odds, survived genocide. Hello, and welcome to the final episode in this series of Learning from Genocide. So far, we have focused on genocides which have, for the most part, ended. Although we, of course, know that peace and stability can never be taken for granted. And it's the current situation in China which we turn our attention to today. Specifically, the atrocities being inflicted on the Uyghur people. Since 2014, the Chinese government, under the direction of the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, has pursued policies that incarcerated more than an estimated 1 million Muslims, the majority of them Uyghurs, in internment camps. This is the largest scale detention of ethnic and religious minorities since World War II. Thousands of mosques have been destroyed, and hundreds of thousands of children have been forcibly separated from their parents. Rahima Mahmood is a London-based singer, translator, and human rights activist, and still has many of her family currently living under persecution in China. She's with me now. Welcome, Rahima.
It's my pleasure.
Can you tell us about your childhood in China?
I was born in a very large family. I'm the number 8. It's a region called Gulja, northern part of what I call East Turkestan. Geographically, it's very close to Kazakhstan. So that's where I was born. And soon after I was born, the Down to the Countryside movement started throughout China. My father had his own business, and therefore, under the communist regime, no one was allowed to do any business. So anyone who didn't have any position within the government must leave the cities and go to countryside to become farmers. And so I lived my childhood in a village called Noraitu. That was where my mother come from. So my grandfather had a very large house, big apple orchards. And he was very worried that the government would take away everything from him because he had more than that he should have. So he divided half of his land, the house. And so my father built a house. So we lived next to my grandparents in a very large, beautiful house up until we moved back to Gulja city in 1980s. So the life during that period, my parents must have had a very tough time. But as children, we were very happy because of the way how we were treated. Also, my mother is very musical and artistic. My uncles and my elder brothers, they all played music. And so I was brought up in this kind of very lively and beautiful environment. And my father was very, very religious man, and he recited Quran whenever he had the opportunity. So I often woke up in the morning with the sound of my father reciting beautiful, beautiful Quran. But when I was quite young, before I went to school, every time when my parents and my elder siblings, when they prayed, they often warned us that not to go out and tell others. And my father often said, if you do, police will come and take me away. So they often locked the gate from inside whenever they did the prayers. So I didn't know, of course, at that time, but when I grew up, then I learned that that was the latter years of the Cultural Revolution when religion was completely banned. So the time after Mao died in 1976, that is the year that I started my primary school, things started to change. So the later the new leadership denounced the Cultural Revolution, and so people were given much more freedom. So the religious freedom was allowed. Also prisoners, people who were taken to labor camps, gradually released those who survived. So I have those vivid memory of prisoners returning home and the joy of families and communities welcoming them, because many of these prisoners, they were not criminals. They were taken away simply because they resisted the Cultural Revolution, the Chinese policies. Many are writers and poets and intellectuals. Then after I moved back from the village to the Rolja city, that was in 1980, I was in year five. My sister, who's just older than me, we were seven girls. My eldest sister was married, and six of us were still at home. And I lost my sister. She suddenly fell ill after we moved to city. And about 2-3 months in hospital, she died. So I can say that was the kind of end of my happy years of my childhood. I find it very difficult to accept because she was only 13. I was about 10, 11. One thing that I learned from that experience, because in the past, I often thought old people die. Only when you get old, you die. And because she passed away at that age, that taught me that death is not something that can happen only when you become old. It can happen anytime. So up until that time, I was a very, very happy child.
That must have been so hard. Can you tell us what happened after that time? It was the end of your happy period, your happy childhood. But what happened in China? Was there a noticeable shift? You know, did your freedom start being affected? And you were just 10 or 11 at this time. How much did you understand of the situation?
Well, that was actually golden period started. People were happy. For Uyghurs, as being Muslim, after so many years not being able to practice religion, lived in kind of fear. And because this is such a big thing, when the religious freedom was allowed, people were happy. And also the revival of Uyghur culture started as well after almost 20 years, you know, being banned. So I went to university in 1987 to study petrochemical engineering. And then 1989, as you know, the student democratic movement demanding the change of one party system. I joined that after we protested in Dalian for about 2 weeks from the beginning of May. And then in mid-May, around 2,000 students from Dalian University of Technology traveled to Beijing to join the students in Beijing. So this happened from all university in all over China, traveling to Beijing to join this movement. And so this is a very first kind of political activism that I have attended. We left the square on the 2nd of June. The organizer from our university told us that if we didn't, then we will be trapped and we might get arrested. So we returned on the 2nd of June, and on the 4th, the June massacre happened. We know thousands of students were killed. From the 1989, after that crackdown on Beijing and the hardline politician, he was appointed to become a president. So that was another turning point. So all the freedom of speech and freedom of assembling, all this were taken away after that student democratic movement. So then I returned home in 1992 after finishing the university with equivalent 1-1 here. And I thought I will find my dream job. My Chinese was just like the Chinese people, and they didn't look at my face. If they just hear my voice, they wouldn't know that I am not Chinese. However, I returned in July, and up until the end of August, I cannot find a job in the capital of Urumqi. And that was a time I learned from my own personal experience how the Uyghurs were discriminated, regardless how well educated you are. I knew that there are many workplaces needed, really desperately needed, someone like me, but all the Han Chinese students who came from many different parts of mainland China, they got their job like within 1 week. And yet I, who born and brought up in that country, after graduated from one of the top 10 universities with a petrochemical engineering degree, and I cannot find a job in Urumqi. In the end, I just had to take a job in a city called Maitag, in an ethylene plant.
So Rahima, you've told us that you were unable to get a job. What other persecutions did you face for being a Uyghur? What was it like for you and your family at that time?
Well, after I started the job in Maitag at this ethylene plant, first of all, I wasn't given the position that I was qualified. And then I worked in a laboratory. My bosses and the managers gave me hell. In the end, I was like crying every day before I go to work. I didn't want to continue there. In this ethylene plant, over 3,000 employees, only 10% of the workforce were Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities. Despite most of the Uyghurs, just like me, spoke fluent Chinese and had the skill or qualified from universities, but we all suffered a really, really terrible kind of discrimination throughout. In the end, I had to leave my job in 1996 and then became a teacher at a college. And that actually was much better. And then 1997, I went back to visit my family. So I went back to Rolja. My son was 1.5 years old. And on the 5th of February, a Rolja protest that took place. I learned on the day in early afternoon that there were young men protesting in the street of Rolja, demanding the freedom of religion and the release of the religious clerics that was detained. So basically from 1995 and 1996, the Chinese government started another wave of crackdown on religion. Many Uyghur religious clerics, especially young ones, were arrested. 3 months crackdown led to many leading religious figures were taken away. So because of this, on the 5th of February, 1997, and the Uyghurs took to the street to protest, demanding that under the Chinese constitution, religion is allowed, is we have the freedom of religion and we have the freedom to practice our culture, because also one of the century-old tradition called the Mashrab, which is a kind of party that it has a religious and also musical kind of element, that was banned as well. So the Uyghurs realized that our freedom is gradually is like taking away, again, going back to like a cultural revolution period. But this time is even worse because of the population of Han increased dramatically and most of the work were taken away from Uyghurs. Unemployment was very, very high. After that Rolja protest, on the evening of that protest, we learned that the military came and opened fire. Over 100 died. And later from that evening, the mass arrest started. Some of my relatives, friends, and the people that I know were taken away. So I left Rolcha really shaken. I decided that if I can find a way, I will leave. Because it's just a matter of time for people like me be taken away, because I'm always quite outspoken as well. So in year 2000, I managed to get a passport and a student visa to study a master's in environmental management here in the UK. And I managed to leave the country with a student visa. Then my son and his father joined me in 2002. They came to my graduation ceremony, and then we stayed. I never went back since I came. My mission was to tell the world about what is happening to my people. People often ask where you come from. I didn't feel I can just say I'm China. I always said I'm Uyghur. People just stared at me, and I realized how little people know about the Uyghur people. And they started joining other groups, NGOs, Tibetan, and the Chinese democratic activists started to promote and talk about the Uyghur situation. And I set up my music group called London Uyghur Ensemble with some really wonderful musicians here in the UK, and so telling the story of the Uyghurs through music. This was the kind of work since I came here, been doing, all focused on one thing, is how best I can tell the world. And then in 2009, July 5th, Urumqi massacre, that happened. That was the turning point. Students led a demonstration after several Uyghurs were killed in a factory of Shaoguan city in Guangdong province. And the Chinese people took the video of these killings and posted on Youku, similar to YouTube. And this outraged the Uyghurs, many students, and then they decided to organize a mass protest, demand accountability of those who killed these Uyghurs. On the day, the peaceful protest, then a similar way of deploying military, killing, opening fire on the Uyghurs. And then later, many Uyghurs took the matter in their hand, had a fight with the Han Chinese civilians. So Chinese government used this in all channels, saying that the Uyghur terrorists, and this propaganda led to the terrible conflict and the mistrust between the Han and Uyghur people. And this is the time that they started to installing the high-tech surveillance camera system. It said no blind spot should be left. And then they called the Uyghurs as the enemy of the state. So that was the start of even severe crackdown in 2009 after that massacre. Extrajudicial killing and extrajudicial arrests were introduced in 2009. So we became most vulnerable people in the region. Whenever there is a conflict or argument with Chinese for any kind of small matters, Uyghurs were branded as separatists and taken away. Many disappeared up until now. We don't know what happened. Thousands of Uyghurs disappeared. Intellectuals arrested. Historians were arrested. I was able to speak to my family. I never went back since I came here. And in 2009, after that protest, we also lost contact. The internet was disconnected and there is no phone allowed for about almost a year. Then from 2010, I was able to speak to my sisters and brothers, but very cautiously. And then in 2016, again, I couldn't get through to anyone. No one would answer my phone calls. For 2 months, I cannot get through to anyone. And then on the 3rd of January, 2017, after repeatedly calling my eldest brother, I was so worried. I was crying and I didn't know what happened, why no one was answering my phone call. And finally, my brother answered my phone call. And when I asked him why no one is answering my phone call, and he said, they did the right thing. Please leave us in God's hands. We leave you in God's hands too. And he put the phone down. And soon after that, I learned that the mass arrests were taking place. Police were raiding houses and they just placed a black hood over the head, handcuffed them and taking them away. So through my interpreting translation work, later I interviewed the survivors of the camps, worked with the BBC for their documentary and also ITV Undercover China's Digital Gulag. So I came face to face to survivors, to people who lost many family members, to women who lost their children and not knowing what happened to them, and also all the survivors they described about the torture, sleep deprivation, also rape is happening in a mass scale, and also forced labor. We learned from the 2018, there's also big wave of Uyghur forced labor program. People either taken from these concentration camps and to factories, or they build factories along the concentration camps and forcing people to work in these factories.
It's so emotional, and it must have been really hard for you to hear from the survivors. I know it's really important to you and to us to tell everybody what's happening. Do you think there's anything that our listeners should be doing? What can we do?
Being in this country where you have freedom to speak, to assemble, to protest. The first number one thing I believe people need to educate themselves about what is happening. There are many documentaries and also Uyghur Tribunal. I will highly recommend people to visit the tribunal website and listen to the statements from the survivors and the experts about what is happening, and fight the disinformation from the Chinese government that they're completely denying about what is happening. So that is number one thing. Also, join the Stop Uyghur Genocide campaign. It is really important that we have more people to join. So we have several campaigns now, forced labor on Winter 2022 Olympic, demanding boycott, asking the athletes to speak up. We still need to pressure on our politicians to not to attend the Olympic, to give the honor to this genocidal state. And also the products from China tainted by the Uyghur forced labor, especially cotton. 84% cotton come from my region. And therefore, we also ask people boycott Chinese cotton goods. Also, be aware of what you buy when you buy like any Chinese made phone. I know these are not something so big. You know, when comparing the scale of the atrocities and the abuse that Uyghurs are facing. But in the West, this is the least that we can do. And also organize events if you can, and invite Uyghurs survivors to speak. So in that, to raise awareness as well. And we also have like protests every month outside the Chinese embassy on the 5th of every month. My latest experience, only about less than 2 weeks ago, I sat face to face with ex-Chinese policemen who gave evidence at the Uyghur Tribunal, also the CNN Daily Mail, who revealed the torture, the intention of the Chinese government of eradicating the Uyghurs, using the excuse branding the Uyghurs as terrorists. So it was very hard to listen and to hear from someone who executed those orders. At times, he was very distressed, even had tears in his eyes. and felt very guilty, but also very angry, upset, saying that this should never happen and the world should punish this government. In the end, I couldn't carry out this any longer. He said, when I was in mainland China as a policeman, I used to punish criminals who did bad things. We were called to assist the police in Xinjiang. They said there is a separatist and terrorist movement. And he said, when I went there, there is no such thing. People cannot even talk freely. There are barriers or, you know, checkpoints. He said there are checkpoints every 200 meters everywhere. And how is it possible for these people can do anything? And then he said one of the guy that I had to interrogate was that he watched a foreign film, which is deemed inappropriate, 2 years before. And then I have to interrogate him to give out more names so we can arrest more, because the government gave these quotas that putting so much pressure on all the jurisdictions of the police to arrest certain number of people, and the people have to make up crime and make up some excuses to take them away. This is from the Chinese policeman. And therefore, I think it is very important for people to know. And I will also recommend them to read the article on Daily Mail and also the CNN, the Sky News, of his interview. It's not easy for me to do these interviews and listen to them, but it is necessary to do it so the world know what is happening.
Rahima is UK director at the World Uyghur Congress and executive director at Stop Uyghur Genocide. Both groups can give advice on what we can do to bring attention to the inhumanity being endured by the millions of people in China right now, including Rahima's own family. If anything this series has taught us, it is that we can never take our freedom and peace for granted, despite the promise after the Holocaust of never again. It's clear that ethnic cleansing and classification of vulnerable groups can and has happened just about anywhere in the world. But with education and vigilance, could any future threats of ethnic cleansing be stopped? I'd like to welcome back as my final guest of the series, Olivia Marks-Waldman, Chief Executive of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, to talk about what HMDT is doing to raise awareness of genocide survivor stories and how we can educate and look to the future. Welcome back, Olivia. It's nice to see you again.
You're welcome. It's lovely to be with you again.
So throughout this series, we've heard so many moving stories from people who have survived unimaginable events. Are there any survivor stories you've heard in your time with HMDT which have stood out to you?
There's one thing we know on Holocaust Memorial Day as we reflect on the past is just the scale and difference of experiences across so many years and so many countries. There's one individual I'd like to make mention of today, and that is Sabina Miller. She passed away a few years ago, so obviously isn't somebody we could have brought into this series. Her experiences stand out for me partly because she was not in a concentration camp. She was hiding in an enormous hole in the woods, in the forest that the resistance had dug out, and she hid there with another person and then was on her own. She later managed to exist under a false identity with the terror that brings every minute of every day. And she stands out for me because she was such a gentle person. As she'd rebuilt her life and her wonderful family, she had managed to hold on to or rebuild such a gentle spirit and such kindness to others. And I miss her all the time.
What's the most surprising thing that has struck you about working with people who have survived genocide?
We're in a very privileged and unusual position at the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. The survivors we work with are survivors who have been able to rebuild their lives, many of them rebuild families, and are able and willing to share those experiences with other people. Not every survivor is able to do that. There are very many survivors who either aren't able to share their experiences or who don't feel they need to. But of the survivors we do work with, many of them show a remarkable gentleness and humanity and lack of bitterness. And that's extraordinary. And I don't think we reflect often enough just how extraordinary that approach is. And I think that's partly because we don't always meet survivors who have not been able to take on that approach, but it's remarkable and it's very life-affirming.
What kind of support does HMDT give to people who have been through genocide?
We're not a charity who has the expertise to provide the therapeutic and welfare support that many survivors need, or the financial support that some survivors need as well. We work very closely with a number of sister charities, such as Jewish Care and AJR, the Association of Jewish Refugees, who themselves do employ social workers and therapists and have grant programs. What we do is enable survivors to share their experiences with other people for educational and for commemorative purposes. And that's the role that we have with survivors and with members of the public, to enable people to learn from survivors. So we work together very effectively with the people who have the right expertise in different areas.
Are there any areas in the world which are currently showing warning signs of approaching genocide?
That's a really serious question. There are charities we work with who have policy and research teams that do an enormous amount of investigation into this. There's the USHMM in America, the United States Holocaust Museum and Memorial, that has a special center for research and policy in this field. There is the charity Genocide Watch and others. So yes, there are situations in the world where we see identity-based persecution. I suppose the most obvious example is Myanmar, where Rohingya Muslims have been persecuted because of their faith and culture, and where a case was brought last year. But I'd also highlight that there are stages on the way to genocide. There's no situation that goes from a benign society to genocide in one leap. There are stages of prejudice, of oppression, of law and policy, of segregation and so on. And we can't be complacent even in the UK. Now, of course, I don't mean that we're about to have a genocide, but even in the UK, anti-Semitism has been on the increase. Anti-Muslim hatred exists. Homophobia exists. Prejudice against disabled people exists. They're not going to turn into genocide in the UK. We have laws against those prejudices where it turns into discrimination. But we can all play a role in challenging people and saying that this isn't right, and that this is not the way to behave to fellow citizens and fellow human beings.
How important is it to educate the younger generation about past genocides? And how do you do that?
The word vigilant is really key here. We're all very, very busy, and it's so easy to fall into traps of just listening to the people we agree with and not looking at things critically, not saying, hang on a minute, is that really true? And not sort of challenging what we're told, particularly when what we're told might be against a particular group of people, whether it's refugees or disabled people. So we can all be a little bit more critical and a little bit more challenging. I'm sure we've all been in those very uncomfortable situations where people around us have made jokes or banter about people that we feel really isn't comfortable. Well, let's not live with that discomfort. Let's try and challenge where we hear things that are not really acceptable. And if we see things that are even more blatant, report it. Report it to the CST, which monitors anti-Jewish hatred. Report it to Tell Mama, which monitors anti-Muslim hatred. Report it to the police. Post comments if we see things online. So those are some things we can do that are very easy and very simple, but too often we're a bit too rushed or we're a bit too busy to challenge them. And of course, we can all learn more. Recent surveys have shown that many people don't know the very basic facts about the Holocaust. and many people don't know about recent genocides, we can teach ourselves a bit more and then we can teach others. Of course, we can share this podcast. We can share the survivor experiences we've been listening to through this podcast series. hmd.org.uk is our website, and there's so much information and so many life stories there that listeners can share with others. It's hugely important to educate younger people. Younger people at this stage can still listen to a survivor, and we work very hard to share those survivor experiences with younger people. But there are so many other things that younger people can learn about, as well as the individual survivor experiences. And of course, Holocaust Memorial Day Trust has so many resources that help younger people, whether it's in their classrooms or if it's in their youth groups. Often, younger people are the most passionate and the most interested, and they need to see modelling from the adults around them. Middle-aged people like me need to be taking an interest as well. And let's face it, middle-aged people are in important jobs that could make a difference, whether it's hosting an HMD event in your offices at lunchtime in January, or whether it's taking a policy within your organization to be more welcoming of people on your staff who have special needs, and remembering that history of persecution and doing what you can not to be prejudiced within your workplace, whether it's suggesting to your local cinema that they screen a relevant film for Holocaust Memorial Day. It's important for young people and for adults to be learning more and to be playing a part in making a better future. And of course, we know that young people use so many different opportunities to get involved with Holocaust Memorial Day. Every year we do some youth engagement project, and this year it's a photography competition. Last year we had hundreds of entries. We work with young people both in schools and in their youth groups, scouts and guides, National Union of Students and so on. So we know young people of all ages are really keen to learn from genocide and to be active in their own communities, to show their solidarity and to take steps to make that better future that will be their future, but is the future that we want to see too.
My thanks to Olivia, and of course to Rahima, for joining me today, and to all the people we've heard from throughout this series. People who've been personally affected by the atrocities of genocide and have courageously spoken about surviving unimaginable things, starvation, the death of the people they love, to start a new life from nothing, and who relive their ordeals so that they can make sure that no one ever has to endure what they have. It's been a real privilege for me to speak to all of them, and thank you for being with me whilst I did so. I'll give the last words to those incredible people. Goodbye.
I'm alive because some extremely unusual things happened to me. They were mostly the actions of adults who absolutely gambled with their lives.
Very fortunate I had permission to come to England by the British people, you know, allow me to have a new life.
This is a form of justice, and I feel like I can actually help combat hatred because I believe my story can be a tool for peace.
That was pretty much the reason why my life and the life of my housemate and actually my neighbors were spared.
I just want it not to be forgotten, and hoping that it's not to be repeated, because nobody deserves to go through what we have been through.
Learning from Genocide is produced by Amanda Redman and is brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust and Trafalgar Strategy. For more information on the stories that you've heard today and ways for you to be involved in what we do, please go to our website, hmd.org.uk.